Time now for our weekly chat with Kevin Woodley from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com. We'd like to call it Crease Lightning. Mr. Woodley, how are you, my man?
I'm doing good. I was listening to the ad segment coming in there. Sports Closet would have been a good name for my jersey collection after I first got married, because it all went in the closet at that point.
But yeah, don't you have your man cave now, or your fan cave somewhere in your garage or your house where you can put a few of them up?
Jason, that's the beauty of being self-employed. It's called a home office now. Yeah. Throw the air quotes around yes. it. This is the space where you cannot dictate what goes up on the wall.
Yes. Nice. I like it. So that's the clue. Just get a home office, and then you can put whatever you up. I like it. I like it a lot. I'm not a big collector of anything, but I do have a signed Muhammad Ali photo where he's standing over Sonny Liston, and I'm telling you, it is it's one of the few things that I've actually been like, now that's something that was unreal. I bought it at a charity auction. I got a steal of a deal, and I loved it. It's fantastic.
See, now that's a piece that, like Ali himself, probably transcends the edict that no sports memorabilia shall go up in the married man's house. So you'd be okay with that one.
Yeah, very true. Now, let's get to the Stanley Cup Finals. Game 3, it's 2-1. Joel Ward takes a shot inside the blue line and basically kind of goes, just beats Murray over the pad under the blocker in between, kind of went right through him. And obviously, now, would you say that's a bad goal, Kevin? Was it a bad break? How would you classify that as a goalie guy?
I hate classifying them. There is no black and white, but that's the job, I guess, right? So I would say that it is a bad break that you shouldn't put yourself in a situation to have happen. Let's put it that way. And because of that, I don't think you can classify it as anything other than a bad goal. Now, some of the factors that went into it, I haven't heard Murray make this excuse, but we've talked before about how, hey, Don Cherry is always right when he rips on defensemen for reaching out with sticks. When I saw Dumoulin's go out, I wonder if Murray saw that release clean. But then I read quotes for him about he felt like it dipped in the air, so that tells me he had a good look at it. So maybe that's not as big a factor. At the end of the day, from that distance and in that situation, even with a good shot, even though he kind of got it off the back leg and maybe the release was a little odd, you would like to see your goaltender one of two things. Either A, guys with more active gloves catch that clean, or B, if you are going to go into a block, shift with that puck and make sure that I think you've got enough time on that one that it should be hitting you kind of dead center, not between that gap. And then it's a tough gap at times to close. That little perfect sort of triangular seam between the top of the pad that's on the ice, the edge of the pants that rise up along the line of the leg, and hey, by the way, that's about to get smaller next year, and fitting that glove in tightly to close that hole. So, yeah, was it bad break that it caught a tiny hole? Yes, but, you know, you put yourself in that situation by, A, not giving yourself a chance to catch it clean, or at least shifting behind it more and putting more of your body behind it. And, hey, I could also argue, Francois Allaire was famous for this, and I've seen other goalie coaches do it. A block is a block. You don't want to be a blocking goaltender, but when it's time to block, you better have all those bloody holes closed. So I've seen Allaire, I've seen other guys put a guy in his block and take a stick and try and basically jam it through those holes and make sure that they aren't there. Make sure that when you're relying on your equipment, it's going to do the job you need it to do. And so, yeah, bad break, it found the hole, or poor job of making sure that hole wasn't closed up, or B, you were not relying on that space to stop the puck. At the end of the day, it's one that Murray needs to have. It's one that I think he'd agree he has to have. Bright side for the Penguins, both in this series and moving forward with Murray, is he didn't get rattled by it. In that situation, from that distance, with that crowd, he made some saves afterwards that were in character. He did not start chasing. He did not change his approach or how he played. And those are all positives after what a goal that I can't find very many positives about.
Now, what about the overtime goal? You and I talked about tendencies. Was that a scouting report? You talked about Murray when he goes from right to left, left to right, that maybe sometimes it dips down a little bit. Was that a case there?
Well, for that one, it's a technique we call reverse VH. We've talked about it before. So it's a post-integration technique for sharp angle plays and wraparounds, and Donskoy's a threat from below the goal line originally, and so Murray goes into it. And so you've got that lead pad down on the ice, and your back pad is supposed to drive that coverage into the post and kind of help you pivot around the post as the play moves up ice. Murray's tendency in this situation, and we documented it at NHL.com in the scouting reports from the second round on, is to drop that right arm paddle down every time he uses reverse VH on the blocker side. Hasn't cost him often, but it has cost him now a couple of times in the playoffs. Creates a lot of double coverage. I mean, if you look at it from the puck's perspective coming out of the corner or from below the goal line, he basically has that paddle of his stick and the blocker in front of his pad. Two areas of coverage covering the same space. And because that hand is driven down to the ice with the blocker, the shoulder can no longer fill up to the crossbar. So there's a noticeable gap there. It's been in his play throughout. It's something I wouldn't be surprised to see them change heading into next season. But for now, I don't think you ask him to change that, you know, to make a change in the middle of the Stanley Cup playoffs. It's just a tendency that's there, and through a series of circumstances, great play by Donskoy to take that from a dead angle play where Murray probably would have had it covered to a bit of a better angle shot, and Murray stayed down rather than coming up and didn't have a lot of time to kind of move out a reverse VH, and hey, it hits a stick and then it hits the side of Murray's head and goes in. So a lot of circumstances lead to the goal, but no question that's a tendency that has been pre-scouted for sure by the Sharks, because we've been talking about it and others have been talking about it ever since Murray got into the playoffs in round one. And, in a, you know, obviously it cost him at a pretty big moment of that game in game three.
Yeah, you know, I love that. You know, that's why I like this segment a lot. I learn a lot about the goaltending position, you know, the reverse VH. So it's something that he's done, and he's not going to be able to just eliminate it from his game going into game four, correct?
No, but here's the thing. It's been there throughout, and there's been a couple of goals that you could argue were a result of it. I think of the one really bad angle goal. I can't remember which game, but in the Washington series, I think it was Jay Beagle. Remember, chipped it up over the – got it dumped in just above the goal line, and in one motion chipped it up and over the shoulder. Great play by Beagle. Under pressure, kind of a quick tip. I'm not sure you could say he picked the spot, because that's – otherworldly skill level if he did, but again, the hole was there and the Capitals knew it was there, and there were other times where they tried to pick it as well. So it's not something that's going to change. It is a tendency that is what I like to call an exploitable tendency, but that doesn't mean it's easy to exploit. And for the most part, it's very certain situations. You've got to take that play from below the goal line where he's pretty much covered to above the goal line and then pick a pretty small window. And as we've seen so far, the way the Penguins defend, they don't usually give you the time and space to pick a lot of spots, especially once the play gets in tight. And even in that situation on the OT winner, Donskoy didn't have a lot of time, and it still took a deflection off a Penguin stick to find that gap above there. So it's exploitable. It's a tendency. It's not going to change. It's going to be there for the rest of the series. Whether or not the Sharks get the opportunity with enough time and space to use the skill to exploit it remains to be seen. But if they do get the chance, you can bet that's where they're going to be looking to go with it.
Kevin Woodley joins us from In Goal Magazine and NHL.com. Now, Kevin, because it was deflected off a stick, does that, you know, that's why it's not classified as a bad goal. But if Murray's playing that correctly, that area wouldn't be open. Is that what you're suggesting?
Now, I'm suggesting there wouldn't be as much of it open. I mean, I think in a perfect world, I agree that with his decision to go into reverse VH, some people have questioned that. But, you know, if Donskoy wraps it quickly and it goes in off his skates while he's standing up, that's a bad goal for sure. He would have had to get up pretty quickly out of it to have that net covered on his feet. But, yeah, it's one of those ones where, yeah, again, it's a tough bounce. But the way he played it and the way he plays it consistently puts him in a position where that space is exposed, where he's left himself exposed to either a shot there or a bounce there. When playing it differently, not dropping that lead shoulder as much as he does into paddle down and creating that double coverage, yeah, you'd have that covered up high just by playing it differently. So, yeah, tough bounce. Yeah, you know, it makes it hard to classify it as a bad goal, but there's a way to play it differently where you give yourself a much better chance of making that save than the way he did it.
Kevin Woodley from In Goal Magazine joins us. Now, Kevin, we just saw it. The NHL Combine came and went, and I was looking at a lot of the tests, and I found it interesting that the goaltenders in the VO2 and the Wingate, they were knocking it out of the park. Goaltending conditioning, they are on the ice for the full 60 minutes now. For a lot of it, they're just standing on their skates and they're bent over. But still, you know, it's not like they get to sit down and rest. So the importance of that, and then what's your thoughts when you look at some of the higher rated goalies in this draft? You know, there's Sochenko and Hart from the Western League, that they're not 6'3" goalies. Is that a concern?
Well, two things. One, on the it is interesting to note how good sort of the aerobic fitness levels are of goaltenders nowadays. I mean, you know, we are so far past throwing the fat kid in net. Nowadays, quite often for the elite guys, they are among the fittest on the team. Now, you're going to have some exceptions. There was a couple good Sportsnet pieces that threw up, I think it was the 2005 draft, and threw up the stats and asked you to guess who it was. It was Price and Pavlik and, you know, some of those guys. Pavlik's fitness levels were horrific. And that kind of manifested itself actually early in his career. His fitness still isn't exceptional, but it's only in the last couple of years that I would argue it's been acceptable. So poor results there can be telling. But in terms of, you know, the bench press and the numbers like that, I thought it was really interesting to see that, you know, none of the guys back in 2005, including Price, including Rask, Pavlik couldn't do one on the bench press, but a lot of the other numbers were well below what you'd expect of other players, and yet, clearly, Tuukka Rask and Carey Price have no problem stopping pucks. I mention that only because I still know prospects who, after getting picked, and there will be goalies who get picked this summer, that then are given a workout training program to follow in the summer and into their development camps or out of their development camps, that still include reaching certain targets on the bench press in order to pass their team physical heading into their first training camps in the fall. And when I talk to goalie-specific trainers and even a few educated agents, the absurdity of that, the stupidity of that, boggles the mind. There are still teams that are asking their goalies, demanding that their goalies focus on exercises that not only have nothing to do with how they play the position, but threaten to create sort of a muscle-bound gym body in certain ranges of motion where you least want it. In other words, are detrimental to goaltenders with things like using a bench press to measure their fitness level when they come into camp. So there's my rant on the fitness stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get off the deep breath now.
I like it.
Now we get into the height. If you see the same skill set, the same talent level, the same athleticism, as much as that term is often misunderstood in goaltending, in a kid who's 6 foot, a kid who's 6'3", you're taking the kid who's 6'3" every time. Are there teams that are going to completely stay away from the six-footer, like Hart, like Sochenko, based strictly on size? Yeah, I believe there are some that won't touch them strictly based on that. But I think we're moving away from blanket statements, for the most part, that you can't be a good goaltender at 6 foot. For one thing, not that you can count on it, but a lot of these kids aren't necessarily done growing. I don't know about you, but my biggest growth spurt was between grade 12 and first year university. And I kind of wish I'd had it playing baseball beforehand, because I was 5'10" when I finished high school and ended up going to university at just under 6'1". So, and the difference between, we've seen it actually with Eric Comrie, undersized guy at the draft who's now closer to 6'2" playing size. And when I watch him in the net, and actually did some work with him this summer, and I remember Doobie being on the ice saying, I thought he was small. And you watch the way he controls the net space. The Swedes have a term for it called box control, where you are not worried about the big net behind you, but you're focusing on creating a little net in front of you, understanding that if you're centered on the puck, that puck has to come through that space in front of you to hit the big net behind you. And it really is amazing how small that space is when you present it that way to a goaltender. And I watch a guy like Comrie at 6'1", 6'2", and NHL shooters shooting on him in the summer, and they can't beat him off clean looks. Cannot beat him because he doesn't open up the space. He closes down into that space, and that's where we talk about tracking. And I don't think it's as big a concern as some would make it out to be. I don't know that a lot of teams are identifying that skill set, particularly in terms of the tracking. I know that Hart does it pretty well. Sachenko's on it, as well. So maybe there's not a coincidence those two, as undersized goalies, are having the success they're having. But if you look at the big picture and you look at how they move and how they track, it doesn't have to be a negative. It probably shouldn't be a negative if you're a fully educated team in terms of assessing your goaltenders. But I'm not going to pretend that even half the NHL is fully educated when it comes to assessing goaltenders at this point.
Kevin Woodley from In Goal Magazine, NHL.com, joins us. And the reason I ask that question, Kevin, because we do see for position players, skaters, or goaltenders that, yes, size is an advantage in the eyes of some, but ultimately you can still make it in those positions at 5'8", or 10", or what have you. But in goaltending, it seems that it's shrinking more and more. And if you're not 6'2", almost, you virtually have no chance, right? And I wonder how discouraging that is for goaltenders, because you can be an electrifying goalie, but the butterfly style allows you, if you're taller, to just simply cover more of the net.
Yeah, no, you can do all the same things. That's why I said, if you see the same skill sets in a 6-foot kid and a 6'3 kid, you pick the 6'3 kid every time. Same argument. I remember saying this when the debate in Montreal was over Carey Price and Yaroslav Halak. Forget all the other skills and how they were playing at that time. I'm taking Carey at 6'3 over Yaro, who is lucky to be 5'11 or 6 foot himself. So every time I'm making that decision. I guess what I'm saying is, if you can identify certain skill sets, there are also a lot of 6'4" and 6'5" guys that do nothing but open up holes and turn away from pucks and may not have as much success as the 6'6", 6'1". So if it's the right kid and the right skill set, I don't know that you shy away from it, but certainly the ability to survive in the league as a smaller goaltender has gotten harder and harder because of the mindset we just talked about. And we talked about this last week. There's another equation about to be thrown into this mix, and that is the sizing chart and the more quote-unquote tailor-fit chest and arms and pants for goaltenders. I think what you're going to see, and we talked about Jonas Enroth as a free agent option last year, and my response was, if I was the general manager, I'd kind of want to see him in his new measurement gear, because it's those guys that appear to be getting cut the hardest. In other words, no more larges and extra larges. We are actually going to see some mediums, maybe even some smalls in the NHL, and it's more likely than not going to be on the guy who's 5'10", 5'11", or even 6', as opposed to the 6'3" guys with, kind of longer wingspan and broader shoulders. So as tough as it is for a smaller goalie now, it may be about to get tougher. I still don't think that means it's an absolute that you can't survive at that 6'1" threshold. You don't need to be 6'4", 6'5". To me, 6'3" is perfect. Under 6', you're just going to have to prove so many people wrong. But, hey, Halak does, Bernier has for the most part, and to this point, so has Enroth. So it's not out of the question.
Kevin, it's going to be interesting to watch. Any guesstimate on when you think the goalie charts will come out?
Still working on private versus public in terms of those charts. The goaltenders have been told they're going to have equipment to test in late June to work with. And again, if I'm a general manager, I kind of want to see what my guy looks like in this new stuff and see how much of a difference it makes. And if I have an agent with one of those smaller guys who's about to hit the open market, I kind of want to know too, and maybe don't want the general managers to know if it is a significant change. I'm not sure how significant it's going to be. I got to be honest, Jason. I've heard different things. And I think at the end of the day, that's probably because it is going to affect different guys differently because it is a sizing chart. Late June in terms of the goalies finding out, but in terms of the rest of the world and the actual impact it's going to have on what happens next season or even into free agency just a few days later, I think we'll have to see. Have to see how long an Enros sits there on the open market. Have to see what these guys look like that are already under contract when they come back to start training camp in the fall. And for me, with some of the pros I'll have a chance to be on the ice with in August, that'll probably be my earliest chance to see it.
Kevin, we look forward to it, man. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next Monday.
My pleasure. Enjoy game four tonight, and we'll talk to you next week.